Open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Macy, if you want to come on up, you're more than welcome to just come right up here. No. We'll just have her just hang. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 571.
We're going to go back upstairs, and she wants you to say hi.
Okay, I will do that. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 571. Senator Gordley and Senator Devlin, if you're out there, we'll have you up as soon as you come in. And let's have Mazin go first, and he's got a presentation for us. And then, Mazin, if you're the keeper of the amendments, we have a number of them, so we need to just get them labeled correctly so we know what, from the A11 to the A16s, who, if we know who presented them and what they do.
Mr. Chair, as we mentioned, A11, what it does basically allows or gives an exemption for bingo halls. That's a very simple amendment. The Dash 13 gives an exemption to the race week.
The Dash 11 are the bingo halls.
The A13 is the racing circles, race meet.
Is it just Portland Meadows, or?
That's the only race meet we have, so must be.
Okay, so A13 is at Portland Meadows.
I don't think we have the Greyhound Park anymore.
No. It only affects one.
And the A14, it allows for the implementation of 2010.
So that's A14 is a delayed implementation.
Until 2010. There's another delayed implementation as well in another amendment.
Okay.
And it takes out the bingo from the original law. So basically,
takes out what?
From bingo halls, takes it out too. So it's also, in addition to the implementation delay,
it exempts bingo halls.
Right. Yeah. 15. Allows for the smoking and cigars, cigar premises, cigar bars.
Okay, hearing good things about that amendment.
And that's a delayed implementation.
Oh, and with delayed amendment.
Until 2009.
January 1st, 2009.
Right. Okay, so. And Senator Burdick, that's the date that you're looking towards.
Correct. And that's the date that I think there's consensus around,
okay.
And the Dash 16s are moot because they do the same thing as the Dash 15s, but they don't delay the implementation date because one never loses hope, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And Senator Burdick, before we, for Mazin, this bill really comes from Judiciary. It just happens to be here. Anything you'd like to say just by way of introduction of the bill? And
well, we had extensive public hearings in one of our out-of-town hearings at Lewis and, well, actually, we had the hearing in Eugene, which we scheduled it at the law school, and we like having it in Eugene because Eugene has actually lived under this system for quite some time. They were grandfathered in when we preempted the rest of the cities and counties. And so we got testimony from Eugene on how it's working there and a lot of testimony in favor and some testimony against it, obviously. We did hear some testimony from the owner of a tobacco shop. So there's a very narrow exemption that we put in for tobacco shops that like to let the customers sample the wares, if you will. And it's, again, very narrow. And we also changed the 25-foot from a doorway provision to a 10-foot provision in recognition that in urban areas, it's a very logistically difficult. We got this information from the state of Washington that was very logistically difficult for them. And also bar and tavern owners testified that with 25 feet, they really couldn't watch over their customer. They couldn't maintain control of the customer base. So it's a good, strong bill, but it's also a very practical bill, and I think it'll do a lot for public health in Oregon.
Thank you. I know you've worked exceedingly hard, probably harder on this bill than just about any other this session, getting it to this point.
With a lot of help, Mr. Chair.
With a lot, yeah. Well, here's one of the Senator Devlin and Senator Cordley. Please. And I need to say hello to Macy, who's watching, and I promised I'd say hello to her, so thank you for indulging me. Hi, Macy.
You too can say hello to Macy also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hello, Macy. And members of the committee, for the record, I am Mavelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County, and just wanted to stop down briefly to say to Senator Burdick, thank you for your leadership and all of your hard work in shepherding this bill along, and to you, Mr. Chairman, ditto, thank you for hearing the bill. This is a public health issue. This is a public health issue. I've heard from a great number of musicians, from employees of bars and restaurants who are very concerned about their health and are hoping that this will be the session that we finally address the issue and address it as a public health issue. I would just add, just a personal note, as someone who enjoys live music, jazz, blues, there are certain venues that I cannot visit because of the smoke and the effect on my health and a lung condition that I have. And I know there are a lot of folks out there who have these challenges and who are prohibited from participating in community life in the way in which they would like to, again, because of the public health issue involved in smoke-filled bars, smoke-filled restaurants, these public places that still have this problem. So again, I just want to thank you for hearing the bill. Thank you for your leadership, and I hope to see this move out of committee. And again, I hope that we recognize it is a public health issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cordley. I believe it will move today. It's the plan. Questions for Senator Cordley? Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Well, good morning, Macy. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to be very careful here because I think I'm actually repeating testimony that you've already received. At least I would guess that you've already received it, so I'm going to try to go over it very quickly. You all know that prior to the start of this session that there were 16 states that had broad smoke-free policies. Now there are 19. If Oregon adopts the policy that's before you, you will become the 20th. You all very well recognize the impact of smoking on our society, the impact on health care. You also clearly recognize the impact of secondhand smoke, particularly to children, and particularly some of the impacts that can have there. You're also probably well aware that according to the Surgeon General and practically every health expert that's out there, whether it's national or international, there is no safe exposure level to cigarette smoke. Given that, I think that what we have here before us today is an opportunity to move ahead. In the 2001 session, when the last time we visited this issue, I was very much actually in favor of a very broad ban on smoking, both in the workplace and in places of public accommodation, restaurants, etc. In fact, I was so adamant about it, and I'm so adamant about smoking issues, and I'm not actually an ex-smoker. It's almost all from a health standpoint, that I've almost felt that if I was sitting in a different branch of government in the judicial branch, I would recuse myself from any case, because I do think I have a clear, very strong feeling about this issue. But I was posed with a very big dilemma in 2001. A broad ban on smoking in all those places was not going to pass. And Governor Kitzhaber, at that time, put together a deal that basically was a huge advancement, to be quite honest. And that's what I had to take into consideration in banning smoking in almost all workplaces, something that had been talked about for probably a decade or more, but we had never gotten close to. Well, I was stuck between a personal dilemma of where I felt we should be and where my district was. And for that very reason, that I probably wanted the broader ban, but I thought that my district and residents of the state would want the advance that we could get with that deal. I voted for that plan. Now it's only 6 years after that, but I can actually tell you my own personal feeling is that the public mood has moved dramatically even in 6 years. And that now the public expectation is that smoking, because of its impact, particularly secondhand smoke, is no longer acceptable in any public environment in which a person will be exposed who will not have control over that exposure. That's why I think that we need the broadest ban that we possibly can. That is why I think Oregonians right now support that. In a short period of 6 years, I think they've moved broadly into that direction, and I think that's the expectation that Oregonians and my constituent and your constituents have. Therefore, I would urge you to approve the bill as presented, and I hope that it will pass. I think it will pass relatively, not easily, but by a fair margin in the Senate, and may have a little bit more difficulty in the House. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. Senator Devlin, appreciate you being here this morning. Appreciate your passion on this issue. You made a statement about children.
Yeah.
And how secondhand smoke, you know, especially damaging to children. And yet this bill has nothing to do with children. From what I can read, it relates to smoking in, because we basically banned smoking in all public places except in bars and taverns, and I don't think children are available to enter those establishments.
Yeah. Well, Senator Starr, Mr. Chairman, the bill that we passed in 2001 had some pretty broad definitions of what a bar was. And to be quite honest, I could be sitting in the restaurant here. You could be at the bar there, even if we were this far apart, and that could be considered the bar, and this was the restaurant, and their child could be sitting here, and you could be smoking at the bar under the current law. Because it didn't actually require that they be completely separate, and all that there had to be, even a low partition, like the dais there, is sufficient under that law.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions for Senator Devlin? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the time and your passion. Senator Bakken?
Just watching.
Okay, let's go. Mazin, you have some information to present to us.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In your packet, I've included a few material for your consideration. The bill, as we see it, has a revenue impact, and it is our duty in this office to give you the price tag for the policy decisions that are acted. With your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I would like to go to
there
and just explain how we look at
arrived at.
Without sound effects.
Without sound effects.
Now, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do apologize for the quality of the video here, because it seems like our AV equipment has been affected by somebody pulled the plug or something, so we had to go the second round of what's so-called S venue.
Could you pull up weather.com and get the 10-day forecast while we're...
Sunshine.
I think it is sunshine.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, Mr. Chair, this issue has obviously a great appeal and emotion to a lot of people. So we will try to look at it from the economist's point of view. And most of that point of view is well known to be impassionate and inaffectionate at all. So allow me to do that. Let me just talk quickly, refresh your memory about what we've talked about at the beginning of the session on January, about what tobacco revenue is and how we have with Washington and new and old interactions with tobacco. And then we will talk about risks and potentials of the different policies. Now, just to go quickly in a memory refresher, this is what we looked at with different segmentation of the tobacco tax. And at the end, the last bar, this is what you would see if House Bill 201 or anything that is similar to it. This is what we would show at the Healthy Kids new amounts. So the significant increase in taxes will generate significant increase in revenue. Although, as you would see here, the reduction of the amounts that is dedicated today due to the reduction in consumption, and because we have in tobacco taxes, each pack of cigarette has a certain amount of cents dedicated to a certain function. Therefore, if you have reduction in that, those cents are less in their production. So, and just quickly to put things in perspective, this is what Oregon is today. Let me take it back here. Oregon would be in number 16 today if we have House Bill 2201 passing, it will bring us to number 3. And then, of course, if you, as we always do, put sales and excise tax together, in order to make the picture more coherent, you will be looking at Oregon being in the 20th at $1.18, and with the House Bill 2201, it will be at number 6. Now, why do we tell you all that stuff? Is the important thing is we have a tax revenue forecast, cigarette tax revenue forecast. This is the December forecast. I want to bring to your attention that this forecast is not declining. This is a forecast that also takes, for example, the measure 30th. This is when 10 cents decline went down with the 10 cents decline was part of measure 30th defeat in the polls at the 2004. We still didn't see an increase or a decline. What this is telling us is we have a very strong revenue forecast for cigarettes, or for cigarette revenue, tax revenue. This is quite unusual in anywhere else, and we would see coming why that is the case. This is cigarette tax if we take them in packs. So all the cigarette tax that we are looking at in revenue, and we take that and deflate it by the amount of tax revenue. This is $1.18 per pack. You are looking at a very steady amount of consumption. Now, contrast that with this picture of coming down. So, at the beginning of this session, we showed you this picture, if you remember in our orientation in January. What we said, this is the forecast as we see it today. The price increases, if there were the price increases,
And what we have, the Washington effect too. So the Washington effect brings down the revenue. Price increases bring up the revenue. And what you end up with is this line here, because there is an adjustment sort of thing. Now, we also at that time alerted your attention that if you have bands, this is also what happens just by themselves. If you combined all these effects, this is the picture of consumption that you would end up with. This is the bottom one. This is what we look at, cigarette tax revenue, and that's where the amounts that we look at and the reductions comes from. So you have here the revenue in the red line, and you have the packs, that is cigarette packs, in the blue line. And this is current law December 06 forecast. If, again, just to drive the point, if you have 84.5 increase without elasticity, this is the amount of tax revenue you'd be looking at. And, of course, with elasticity, things will look differently, and consumption will look differently. And, again, you enter into the unique situation that we live in here in Portland, the state of Oregon, if you will. And because you have a population effect that you need to figure into the whole picture. And the population effect, because of the proximity that we have with Washington and Clark County, where we have people moving back and forth in numbers, and they could use or practice whatever they want to do at much easy time and no restrictions. So the population effect here is where we show it. Then this is a slide that we showed the House revenue at the time of 2201. We called it the Washington-Oregon smoke dance. And why is it a smoke dance? Because you would look at this issue and see where the relationship between Washington and Oregon when it comes to sales and taxes. The dotted line is the differences between the tax rate in Washington and the tax rate in Oregon. You have, this is the packs sold in thousands in Washington, and these are the ones in Oregon. Now, if you see how when Washington goes down, because as a response to the tax rate differential, we're steady. So, in other words, if you want to say when we're solid or rock, they're rolling. So it's a rock and roll relationship. You see it here again. They're coming down. We're steady. Now, when it stabilizes for a long time, the difference, you see how we come down quite quickly. They're more on the steady side. Again, the difference, they go down, we're steady. But then something interesting happened in the relationship. All of a sudden, things started changing. For the first time, they're going down. We're not steady. We're increasing. That was something unique that we have seen. So we wanted to look at it a lot closer. And of course, we know that they have a tax increase and they have smoking restrictions in place in the same time, too. So if it was a smoke change in price, we'd expected the old relationship to occur, which is they go down, we stay steady. But we're still climbing. And that's the climb that we thought at some time. But the climb started here, and we see that part of the climb, most of it at that time at least, before the ban was in effect, is a new policy that the Department of Revenue put in place, which is the credit card if you remember that policy that you cannot deliver cigarettes to the state using credit cards if there has none been payment for the tax. However, that just explained this area here. This increase is still what we look at with the dance, as we say. Now, you look how Washington will actually thank us with any time that we match their... if you see, every time we match their policies, there is an increase. The increase again. When there is a discrepancy, we go through a decrease. So the relationship is quite pronounced and quite obvious almost. So in order to be able to get this thing out of the context of how much is it really price and how much is it smoking restrictions that is pulling people to the easier place to smoke, the way that we thought is most prevalent in this case is, what if we put both the population, both the smoking something, in one big conglomerate population, if you will. So it became, we put them together, and he said, if these guys, this is cigarette stamp sales, and in a 12-month moving average, here we see the Oregon climb, this is the Washington decline. We put them together, we basically normalize, if you will, normalize the relationship, and we take out the dance from the relationship and allow it to move within its one big geographical area, if you will. Now, once you do that, you have established a normal or bias-free type of series. And once we establish this bias-free type of series, you could look at the long secular decline in smoking. There is almost no mistake about it here. Now, this is the time that we live in right now. This is what we have seen. It is a decline still, nevertheless. You allow for that trend line to prevail. So the trend line takes care of itself, and it starts going down to the same. Now, remember, this trend line is also above this area that we have right here. So at this point, what we established is this is the behavior of smoking or the consumption in cigarettes if everything else being left the same. In other words, left to its own devices, smoking will continue declining as far as we can see. And if we look at these percentages of the decline as we see it on monthly basis, we're talking about something of 1% or 2.5% a month. It's about 6.5% a year that's going forever. So again, as Keynesian economists would say, if market forces left to their own devices, they will ultimately collapse. Would say smoking in Oregon and Washington left to its own devices will continue declining for a very, very long time. Now, once Oregon starts regressing to the mean, and this is the relationship that I want to bring your attention to. There's a difference between why the decline is a secular decline that needed to represent the inner dynamics of smoking consumption versus the forecast that we looked at. Remember, the forecast that we were looking at was it an increasing forecast, a forecast that was sustaining its amount. So if we allowed it, Oregon used this relationship and allowed it to regress to the mean, come back to where it is. So you would have this forecast today, these amounts that we have today, and then allow the, take the forecast impact, since it is going to go back to the trend of reduction, because once you equalize and normalize between the two population, there is no preferential pull or push, if you will, going from this state to the other. And then you allow for this all these trend reductions and the price differences and population, we see that the first year reduction will give you about 9.6% reduction. From that point on, actually, still our reduction in Oregon is lower than what the trend would be. As again, the trend would, as we saw in both populations, will be going at 6% because of the price differential that still exists today between Oregon and Washington. We think the total change is only half of what the trend would have been otherwise. So you have it at 2.3, 2.6, and 3.9 decline from that point on. So again, if you these are the quick assumptions that you could see that we've used for this regression to the mean, if you will, of Oregon, and then you look at it, and we add to say the question comes is how would price will enter into the equation if price was in. This is what smoking restrictions would cause. And reduction of revenue, we estimate about 54 million a biennium, the first biennium about 82, the second biennium. If smoking reductions as well as price equalization happens, that means if we equalize our price with Washington, then the impact is obviously bigger. Now, once we regress to the trend, this is the how the picture looks. And you could see this is the smoking restriction and this is the price. And this is where we were at the time when Washington instituted its smoking restrictions. We were going down after, you remember this is the 2002, after measure 20, that we put the increase, we started going down and then started going. So if you could almost see where it is and requires to go. This is the same picture, slightly different, because it reacts differently with other tobacco. Remember, other tobacco has smokeless tobacco, which provides substitutes for tobacco that are not necessarily smoking, therefore it won't be under the restrictions. So restrictions and price act at a different, bigger price. So in a nutshell, once that we established this relationship and we said we are not going necessarily to assume that the policy will be extra successful, only that the policy will bring us back to where the trend line is. Once we did that, and we tried to put the Washington effect back into the model to see how much of the of those packs that we think will be smoked less in the state. We're talking here about 20 less million packs on average year in the coming biennium. About 4.4 of them is are coming from Washington. So the contribution, if you will, of the Washington residents going back or not coming any longer to smoke in Oregon is about 23% of the decrease in the first year, then 19, and because it starts going back and no longer. Now remember, the reduction that we showed you first is only the 2%, but this would be the cumulative effect, because it's biggest at the first time, and then as cumulatively it comes, it starts going down. So the consumption reduction, we wanted to just have a reality check. Is that possible? The numbers sound a little large. So if you take a quick reality check on this, and you're talking about a total PAX, we have about $236 million a year of tax revenue. And it just works miraculously. If we divide the $236 million by $1.18 tax rate, you get about 200 million PAX a year. 200 million PAX a year, you take them daily, 365 days, you end up by 548,000 PAX a day. That's half a million PAX a day of cigarettes. However, a lot of people, when they are talking about smoking prevalence, they say the average smoker is smoking a pack a day. So if that is true, the average smoker is smoking a pack a day, although just a few minutes from now I'm going to tell you how it is not true. but if the average smoker is smoking a pack a day, as many people believe in research and in surveys, you're talking about 548,000 people smoking a pack a day. So that's, if you're talking about a 20 million reduction, that's about 55,000 a day of less cigarettes. What is that turn to be? About 2 cigarettes less per day per smoker. That's not out of the reasonable. However, I am in debt to many of the health advocates.
Madison, we have about three to 5 minutes, and we should do the lottery also.
We'll do that, sir.
Okay.
I've put also in your packet a paper about the effect of smoke-free workplace on smoking behavior. This was given to me actually by Mel Cohen. And what this paper says, and in the different research that you would see, the average you're talking about of reduction due to policies of that sort is about 3.5 per average in smokers. That's what it is suggested. So in a lot of sense, we're still far away from what it should be. In Washington, we're talking about 410,000 people reducing 10 packs. And in these here, I'm just going through different estimation of different sorts and looking at the 3.1 that is suggested will give you about 36.6 million reduction versus the 20 that we're estimating. That's about, and also this paper, what's interesting about it, it compares and really puts into effect that the reduction or the restriction versus tax increase, and how does that work. And what it says is about this, in effect, is increasing the tax rate by about 35 cents to 40 cents. So if you put it in the elasticity that we have, you're talking about 9.6 million. All these are double checks, if you will, to see the reasonableness of our estimate. Same ideas here. Since we're getting short in time, I'm not going to go through all of them. But we have different also the issues that come as risks and potentials here is reduction in business. Always the questions has been, and from both sides of the equation says, well, there is a big reduction in business from the opponents, and the proponents estimate that there is actually no reduction in business. And by the way, depending on how they say it, they're both true. The different research, however, what it says is there is actually no negative reduction in business. However, if you have, there is a number of methodologies that have been using the NAICS statistics and so on. And basically what it allows the estimates to look at is how the increases or the growth in the industry, the bar and restaurant industry versus the retail and other businesses. And if you once start looking at that, you look at the California, the restaurants and bars growing by only 6.5% versus 29% for other like businesses. And when you take the whole United States minus the restriction states and so on, you could see obviously that there is an impact on it. However, they have a lot more sales tax issues than we do. This is what the New York City prohibition have caused, and you could see after a while restaurants and bars are still down. And this is the New York State, and you still also see that this is still the lottery impacts. This is what reductions, we've looked at reductions in Corvallis, its surrounding areas, lottery in Eugene, neighboring areas of Eugene, other changes in taxes, and line game growth. Now, the reduction in Corvallis, this is how Corvallis looked before the smoking ban implemented July 1st, 1998. There was a 22.8% reduction. However, from that point on, it started growing back again after this point here. And the amazing thing is once you put on the line games, you have 36.7% increase. Now, this is significant because it is above and beyond any increase in the other parts of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In order not to be completely off balance, we took the reductions in Corvallis neighbors and say, how is Linn County comparing? And we saw Linn County is not supposed to go in a reduction. It's supposed to see an increase as a level of equalization, go about 6.8% reduction too. So there have been something at that time going in Corvallis. It's not all the smoking reduction. And you see the increase here is 30%. Now, look at Eugene. Eugene says in July 2002, which is this year, the ban starts. But the reduction started a year before. It was 9% reduction in the year before. Yes, they continued here. They're not as strong as it had been, but the reduction started a year ago. Now, if you notice, this is July 2001. We were going through a recession. And this is also true in other places. Eugene also was very high per weekly average sale per retailer. It went down almost to state average. If you look at lottery average in the state, you see how this year was weak. The year after that was also weak in the standard of the lottery. 1.5% growth for the lottery is really, really weak. So what does that tell us in all? There will be a reduction. There will be an impact on lottery by the policy. However, because of the phenomenal growth that the line games are going through, it is really difficult to pinpoint how much that reduction would be, because it as it is growing by multi tens of folds and of increase, it is difficult to be able to pinpoint or sift out, if you will, what the reductions would be according to the lottery from that point on. So, but from everything that we have seen, you know, the lottery, every 1% of reduction is about $13 million. At this point, we really can't put a percentage on how much that will be, but we know there will be reductions. So, in other words, policy decisions of where we most balance is something that you're battling with at this time. Of other bills, also the mechanics of what works and what doesn't. And I'd have to mention this. This is the risks of taxing sin. Because sin has two sides. It's attractive on one hand. On the other hand, however, a better behavior would allow it to go down. So if it goes down, if the policy is successful, if you reduce smoking, then your revenue will go down with it too. The same thing will be with lottery. If you fight gambling too much and you're successful and people don't gamble anymore, you would lose revenue. That's unfortunately a fact of taxing sin. However, after listening to all the pros and the opponents and proponents of this bill, this is the way I feel.
You've been through a lot, Mazen. I know preparing that 18-page presentation for us and coming up with the numbers. Questions for Mazen? Thank you very much. Thank you, Mazen. Okay, so let's get through the testimony. We have Mel Cohen, Dr. Cohen. John, do you want to come with him? And Jeff Fellows, would you like to join? I believe it's Dr. Cohen. Dr. Cohen, did you have a longer presentation for us, or just a brief presentation?
Chair Decker, members of the committee, I was going to speak to the health effects briefly.
Great.
About this. I know you're great. Pressed for time. I will try to be brief. Chair Decker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division in the Department of Human Services, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak today. As I said, I'm really going to speak to the health issues involved, which, frankly, are quite considerable.
Dr. Cohn, I guess the people who have the ear, if you could just move slightly that microphone away.
Absolutely. Is that better?
That's not that far away.
Okay.
We're fine. I think it's the people with earplugs. Thank you.
Okay. Tobacco use remains the number one preventable cause of death and disease here in Oregon, claiming almost 7,000 lives every year and another 800 lives from secondhand smoke. It costs us approximately $2 billion a year in both medical expenditures and lost productivity due to premature death and disability. The Centers for Disease Control and the Surgeon General have focused on the importance of this issue as a health threat for many years. And in 2006, the Surgeon General released a report on the health consequences of involuntary exposure to tobacco smoke, that is, secondhand smoke. And this, I think, firmly established beyond anybody's doubt that, in fact, secondhand smoke is a very, very important cause of death and disease. It causes effects on the cardiovascular system, including heart disease, and also lung cancer, a very serious threat also. There's no risk-free level for exposure to secondhand smoke, and really the only way to protect people is to eliminate exposures in indoor spaces. We estimate now that under our current smoke-free workplace law, there are approximately 35,000 Oregonians who work in places where indoor smoking is allowed, and they can inhale these toxic fumes as an unavoidable part of their job. They would have to choose between their health and their job. And we don't believe that anybody should be required to make that kind of choice. Even breathing secondhand smoke for as little as 30 minutes can cause significant changes in physiology of the blood vessels and raise the risk of heart attack. This has also been well shown in the research. According to the U.S. Surgeon General, the debate is over. The science is clear. Secondhand smoke is not a mere annoyance, but a serious health hazard. So here in Oregon, we're working in many different ways to try to reduce exposure to secondhand smoke. But frankly, I don't think we're fully succeeding, and in part that's what this law is designed to address. California and Washington have successfully adopted stricter smoke-free workplace laws, and that's what this law is about, as you know. For businesses, this has some important benefits as well. The change costs them nothing and can improve their bottom line in a number of ways. They can have smaller insurance premiums due to a lower risk of fire and injuries, reduce cleaning and maintenance costs, and healthier employees and higher productivity. Most bars and restaurants that are required to go smoke-free find that business improves, and we believe this would be true in Oregon as well. Currently, more than 80% of adult Oregonians do not smoke, and these folks are likely to frequent these restaurants and establishments. And, of course, there are also benefits for employees who do smoke. Experience shows that when a workplace goes smoke-free, employees who do smoke may finally take the step and quit or cut down on their smoking. And we also believe that smoke-free workplace laws help keep kids from starting to use tobacco because of these changes in the adults that are around them. Our experience with enforcement of the existing law is that the vast majority of businesses are willingly compliant, and we would expect the same under this new law. So with that, I'm going to stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions after the other presenters have spoken as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Senator Burke.
Could I just ask a really quick question? I seem to recall hearing about some data that showed that secondhand smoke is actually more dangerous than firsthand smoke, that there's some data to suggest that the fumes coming off the end of a cigarette are actually more damaging to health than the inhaled smoke.
Senator Burdick, Chair Deckert, yes, there is some evidence to suggest that that's the case. It has to do with the way that the cigarettes combust, and also if they're inhaled through a filter, of course, that would filter some of the things out to the smoker breathing things in, which, of course, would not happen to smoke that just escapes off the end of the cigarette.
Thank you.
One other question, Dr. Cohen. So in terms of just the A15 amendments around cigar bars, if the legislature does put that into the bill, and would DHS be responsible for issuing the licenses to allow these establishments that are currently in effect to stay in effect?
Chair Deckert, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I saw the amendments briefly before I came in here this morning, and I'm pleased that they appear to be drawn fairly tightly, which I think is very important. But I will have to get back to you about that.
So, and we'll hold that, and probably I think we need to recess for other purposes in a few minutes. But it'll be important to me to know that the work of the legislature is held, that if we want to exempt out cigar bars, and that is our intent, that DHS issues the licenses and they are able to be grandfathered into the law. So it'll be important for me to hear from DHS that is the case if we adopt the A15s.
Well, Chair Deckert, I don't believe it's our role typically to issue licenses. We are involved with enforcement.
Right.
And if the law is written in a way that exempts these folks from enforcement activities, we will, of course, comply with that. Absolutely.
Okay, great.
I do have a staff member here. Okay. Thank you.
So if we could just get absolute clarity on that, and we'll have time in the next 15, 20 minutes to do that. Dr. Fellows.
Hi, thank you. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Fellows. I'm a PhD health economist and investigator at the Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research in Portland, Oregon. My research expertise focuses on assessing the health and economic costs of tobacco use and conducting and evaluating tobacco cessation interventions in large populations. And since 2004, I've been a member of the Washington State External Evaluation Committee for the Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. So essentially, each year we review the results of their tobacco control program and sign off on their validity. And that's been my role for the last 3 years. Prior to joining CHR in 2002, I was a staff economist for the Office on Smoking and Health at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where I led the health and economics costs of smoking research and generated a lot of the estimates, state and federal estimates of death and economic costs that are talked about in media today. I also oversaw the domestic tobacco economics research, including research evaluating the effects of comprehensive tobacco control programs, including tax changes, on state-level cigarette consumption. The research incorporated the effects of cross-border sales between states with different excise tax rates. I want to say that a couple things before I begin. First, the testimony here is based on my research and does not necessarily represent the views of Kaiser Permanente or the CDC, so I'm not speaking for them. Also, I have an attached appendix, and this is, I think, the third time I've presented to the legislature here for since February, and I admit that at 1 o'clock in the morning when I was copying, making 20 copies of this, I put in the wrong testimony, copied the wrong testimony. So I'll send you that via email later on today when I get back to my office. It's one of those oh no points that we all dread. Well, I'm honored to have the opportunity to provide you with my assessment of the potential tax revenue effects of expanding the Oregon's clean indoor air law. Clean indoor air laws have been shown to reduce cigarette consumption and increase quitting, so a thoughtful revenue impact analysis is a prudent part of any bill under consideration. However, I'm personally compelled to give testimony today because I think there's a problem in the Department of Revenue's vetting of research. 2 weeks ago, I was asked to review the revenue impact statement provided by Mr. Malik, and where he was suggested that the SB 571A would reduce tax revenues by $54 million in the 2007-09 biennium and an additional $82 million in the next biennium. I thought that, in my opinion, those estimates were laughable. In most professions, including my own, whenever you come up with a new discovery or a very large or a very dramatic effect, we talk amongst ourselves and among my colleagues and I want to present it so that I can get a sense of whether or not what we're discussing or presenting passes a laugh test. And it's a nice way for us to keep from embarrassing ourselves when we get so involved in the data, we don't reach back and look up and take a broader sense of the bigger picture to realize what the cause-effect relationship really is and if this is plausible. In my opinion, there's just simply no way that extending the indoor smoking ban to cover the remaining 5% or 10 or 15% of Oregon businesses could have such a large impact on cigarette consumption in Oregon. So as a response, I estimated what I thought was a likely effect of that, and this was what I had intended to attach to this testimony for your review, and I'm sorry that I'll have to email it to you. But I did send it to Chair Deckert and Senator Burdick, care of Tabitha Engel of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon. And under some, what I did was assume that about half of the restaurant workers in Oregon that would be covered potentially by the ban. And I thought that was a very generous assumption. And I think that meant about 60,000. I think there are 120,000 employees currently working in full-service restaurants and bars. So I figured that maybe half of those would be covered, would be affected by this ban. And as Dr. Cohn suggested, that they estimated that 35,000 would be covered, and so indeed what I was estimating was very generous. And then my intent was to estimate how many of those folks were smokers and how many of those would quit as a result or reduce their consumption as a result of a ban, and using existing literature that demonstrated that about 5%, between 5 and perhaps 10% being generous, of consumption would be reduced among smokers who worked in places that were now covered by a ban. And that was based upon research that essentially had compared populations where there with a ban to populations where there was no ban at all in existence. And that's different than what we're considering here today. We're considering extending the ban to a small portion of those workers. And so that's what I tried to get at. So what I had assumed in there was that based upon that level of reduction in consumption among workers that could be affected, I estimated that between about $400,000 and $800,000 each year would be lost in tax revenue. And so that's essentially $800,000 to $1.6 million, which is about 2 to 4% of the annual tax revenue that you would expect over the biennium. And that's a lot less than the 13% decrease associated with a $54 million tax reduction. I'm aware that a meeting was held with Dr. Cohn and some tobacco control staff and Mr. Malik, and the discussion I think swayed Mr. Malik's position. So henceforth, I'm here. A key component of Mr. Malik's estimate involved reduced border cross-border purchases by Washington smokers, and there are about 94,000.
Oh, I should just point out, because I see Mr. Malik's name in here a lot.
I know.
It is legislative revenue. I think it's a joint process that we use, and
okay.
So we don't have one economist. It is a joint process.
That's all. Yeah. And you know, to be frank, I've never been compelled to actually say someone's name before, and I don't feel good about it.
If it's helpful at all, I can just tell you that it's when you see the legislative revenue stamp on it, it really is. It means it's the product of the office and a number of economists.
Okay, well, I will refrain from that, so without disrespect. No disrespect intended for personally, but for the analysis itself, I think the analysis is poor. So what I estimated was, and I think I can, there's an estimate here. What the research suggests is that there is a loss to cross-border sales, and it is real when there are differences in tax revenues. But I want to remind you, and I put some figures in here, but I want to just state for the committee that this isn't a revenue, this isn't a tax bill. This is a secondhand smoke coverage bill. And in the research that looks and includes cross-border effects for sales, that research has never included a smoking ban. Smoking bans have not been part of that research, and there are no estimates of that effect. And I've added some estimates of what I might suggest. If the 94,000 smokers in Washington who live in close enough to get here and probably to get to Oregon to buy cigarettes for less money, in order to make up the 53 million, they would have to average about 1.3 packs of cigarette smoking per day. So in other words, their smoking habit, they would have to smoke 30 cigarettes a day. The per capita consumption in Washington currently is about 0.6 of a pack per day. That is per capita consumption, and the smoking rates in border counties are not dissimilar than Washington, the Washington state rep overall. So there's a problem here with the numbers.
Yes, Mr. Fellows, in your calculations, did you use the double whammy effect of not only the smoking ban, the location where you could smoke, but also the massive tax that's being proposed right now?
Because even if you did the massive tax, and I did calculate the tax rates, we could, I did calculate if there was a tax increase. And for one of the proposals, testimonies that I gave earlier in the year estimated that our increasing the tax would, given the demand, the elasticity of demand research, and what that elasticity means, that for every 10% increase in the price of cigarettes, you'd get about a 4% reduction in consumption. And what that would mean for the state would be that 84.5-cent tax increase would increase revenues annually by about $100 million, and when you take and lower and remove the differential between Washington and Oregon, you will lose some of that money that comes across. And so that should be taken into account. And that's the prudent thing to do. But however, I think what I estimated was that we would probably lose at the most 7 packs per capita, which actually is more than what was presented earlier. We might lose 7 packs per capita to Washington, but that one of the things about that is that assumes that that's based upon per capita estimates in Washington and their population, and that's a 7 packs per capita for all states included. The research on cross-border smuggling, and this comes from the revenue, the Washington Department of Revenue. They did a study in 2000 that included cross-border smuggling. And they found that there was every penny increase in the tax would reduce consumption in Washington by 0.08 packs per capita. And so that's where I get about the 7 packs per capita effect of a tax in Oregon, the 84% tax. But that's again that the one of the things about that report, and it's available on the website, and I can give you a reference to it, and I cite it at the end of this, is that they don't do state by state, for instance, Oregon to Washington estimates, because the data doesn't allow them to do that. It's a proximal relationship with all states, and so that's Oregon and Washington, and also Idaho. They include Indian reservations. They include this figure, the $7 per capita, would essentially include Idaho and Washington, or Idaho and Oregon. However, but it also can include, by virtue of its proximity to other states, additional states. And therein lies the limitation of that type of analysis. And the authors themselves of the report say that they're not doing Oregon-Washington analyses because their data can't do it. They can't do it. So there would be in there. So the estimates are there. But if I think that what it means, if we wanted to broaden this analysis to consider, and it sounds to me like that's what's being considered, is that this ban, in conjunction with an increase in the state excise tax of 84.5 cents, I think you are still, by any measure, the state of Oregon will still end up in a positive revenue territory substantially, and that again, that the revenue declines based upon secular trends in decreasing smoking, the revenue declines would continue, would be relatively stable over the near term, and so you could essentially count on that money. I will say in closing that I think that there was one thing that was true that was discussed on the presentation, and that was that smoking rates in Oregon and Washington will continue to decline. Beyond that, I found little truth in the numbers that and relationships to that I was seen on the screen. I think if SB 571A becomes law, total tax revenues will fall slightly. But that also does not include the substantial health and productivity gains that will occur when more smokers quit tobacco and non-smoking workers and customers are no longer exposed to secondhand smoke. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fellows. And we are very aware of the trade-offs, both on the revenue side, and obviously this is not a revenue issue per se. It's just as we have to examine the revenue impacts. Yeah. Other questions for Dr. Fellows? Good morning, John.
Good morning,
Mr. Valley.
My name is John Valley. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the American Heart Association and Stroke Association here in Oregon. And today I'm here testifying on behalf of that organization, as well as the American Lung Association of Oregon and the American Cancer Society, which makes up TOFCO, Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon. And I am not an economist, and all of the numbers that have been thrown around have been quite interesting and at times hard to follow. I think one of the things, what I'll try to do now is summarize the written testimony that I presented to the committee and highlight some key points. I think the end of Dr. Fellow's testimony is key. In fact, I think it's the thing that we must focus on, and the chair referenced this just before he introduced me, is that this is a public health issue. And the numbers that I would want to concentrate and hope this committee concentrates on are the 800 people who die every year of exposure to secondhand smoke and the 35,000 workers every year that are exposed to secondhand smoke. Senator Devlin earlier talked about in 2001 there was a decision by the legislature to make a deal with the governor, at the time Governor Kitzhaber, and that deal was that we decided not to protect certain people from what I guess the state could consider a dangerous substance. That was troubling to me at the time, who was working the issue, and it's still troubling to me now that we've acknowledged that there is a dangerous substance. The evidence and the science has become more and more evident. I mean, we have the U.S. Surgeon General saying that secondhand smoke is not just merely an annoyance. It's a killer. It kills people. And so we should protect all our workers from that dangerous substance. And I know Senator Starr earlier talked about, well, at least it's not dealing with children right now. Unfortunately, that's not true. I know Senator Devlin referenced this earlier, but the specific example I'd like to give is that we have bar-restaurant combinations, TGA Fridays or Red Robin, where you have the bar in the middle of the restaurant and then, you know, families sitting around who are exposed to secondhand smoke currently under the law. The way I compare secondhand smoke is sort of like you put chlorine in the pool. You just can't keep it in the deep end. It spreads all over the place. And so we need to protect people from it. And during the Judiciary Committee's work, and I really want to thank Senator Burdick for her leadership and the leadership that was done on the Judiciary Committee, we had tremendous testimony from people all across the state. One of the people we heard from was Rebecca Duffy, a worker who never smoked in her life. Some people might have heard Senator Walker talk about this. I think she's actually framed the testimony in her office because it was so powerful. A mother who never smoked, went to the doctor, found out she had cancer. The doctors asked her, how many cigarettes or packs of cigarettes you smoked, a week? She's never smoked in her life, and now she has terminal brain cancer. These are the people we want to protect. This is the purpose of Senate Bill 571A and Gross. That's why we've seen 19 states and the District of Columbia pass this legislation, comprehensive, protecting all workers from secondhand smoke. With implementation dates, I know Illinois was the last one, January 1, 2008. The revenue concerns that we've heard about today have not happened in these other states. The anticipation of the HB 2201 passing, as someone who's advocating for that legislation and its investment in tobacco prevention education, that was defeated. I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm not assuming that legislation is going to become law this year. And to base the analysis of that on a clean indoor air bill, I think, is incorrect, because we don't know if that's going to become law. But we do know people are exposed to a dangerous substance. And it was also referred to earlier about smoking rates and how they decline. The one thing we do know, and Dr. Koh might be able to refer to this as well, is that we've had a reduction in funding for our tobacco prevention education program. Right now, that program is only funded by a cigarette tax that was passed back in 1996 called Measure 44. And 10% of those funds was to fund the tobacco prevention education program, which helps people quit. It funds the quit line. And with that program, which was viewed as a national model, we saw our smoking rates go down. Well, that program was defunded, resources reallocated, and we've seen actually the smoking rates level off. So I would say a great indicator of how well our smoking rates are going to be is whether or not we're funding an effective, comprehensive tobacco prevention program. I just put that out there because it wasn't really referred to in the presentation. I think that's an important aspect when we're looking at smoking rates in the state. But the bottom line is that we're talking about secondhand smoke here and how it kills people and that we need to protect people from. And I think, there's bipartisan support. I believe that people recognize this is a dangerous substance, and hopefully this legislation will protect all workers from it. Now, I know there's a desire by some to have cigar bars exempted. We've been resisting that in the past just because we think there's a slippery slope that it's going to allow other businesses to potentially want to be exempted. And because of the impact of secondhand smoke, we don't want to see that happen. We've worked with Senator Burdick on these amendments. I believe they're the Dash 15 and the Dash 16, which would be narrowly tailored to really focus on these specific cigar bars. So if the committee decides to do that, those would be that would be the way we would recommend doing it. But, you know, realizing the concern that we're going to potentially, you know, see other businesses exempted. But we think if we're going to do it, we need to do it in a very narrow way. And that was what was done in the Senate Judiciary Committee when we looked at retail tobacco shops with Senator Pruzanski. So I think, you know, the evidence is clear that the public across the country is starting to realize, the science is starting to show that secondhand smoke is dangerous. We hope that this committee will follow the lead of the Senate Judiciary Committee and say, yes, we need to protect our workers from secondhand smoke. We like the way Senate Bill 571A looks now. We don't understand the revenue impact, and we don't think when we're talking about the difference between people's lives and the potential of saving money, and which seems very unclear based on some earlier testimony and the anticipation of House Bill 2201 may be passing, we think it's time to move forward, and we need to act now on Senate Bill 571A. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I really appreciate the opportunity to testify. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Valley. Questions for Mr. Valley or anyone on the panel? Senator Stark.
Thank you. Both, at least twice in comments from two of you, referenced 800 people die from secondhand smoke. How many people will this bill save?
I'll let Dr. Cohen, who's the state epidemiologist, answer that.
How many, and a further clarification, children are referenced frequently in the testimony, and yet there's no ban on smoking in an enclosed area where children are present. Wouldn't that save far more lives, especially for people that have no choice about where it is that they are?
Chair Decker, Senator Starr, to address your second question first, this is obviously a complicated policy choice. It's not good for children to be exposed to secondhand smoke. There's no doubt about that. All of the other policy choices involved in that, you know, are things that are openly debated in the legislature and in public space. And, you know, I suppose if there was a specific proposal put forward, I would respond to that. It's very hard to respond in the abstract except to say that there's no doubt that exposure to secondhand smoke, whether it occurs in a restaurant or whether it occurs somewhere else, in a home, for example, is not good for children. With respect to your first question, I'm sorry, I keep getting too close to the microphone. I apologize. With respect to your first question, I can't tell you off the top of my head how many of those 800 deaths would be saved specifically by this. Perhaps Dr. Fellows knows, but you know, this is a substantial hole in the law. People are exposed to secondhand smoke, these 35,000 workers, on a regular basis. How many actual deaths that's going to avert, off the top of my head, I can't tell you that. I'd be happy to go back and look at the numbers and think about that and see if we can come up with an estimate for you.
I'd like a clarification, too, on a comment that Senator Burdick asked about the secondhand smoke being more dangerous than the smoke that's inhaled. Isn't most of the secondhand smoke that is out there smoke that has been inhaled and then exhaled by the person, as opposed to the what I would think is a tiny amount of smoke that's generated off a lit cigarette?
Chair Deckard, Senator Starr, I think there's a substantial amount that comes off the end of the cigarette. But there is some contribution, of course, from smoke that's exhaled as well, but there's a substantial amount that comes off the end of the cigarette also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Fellows is dying to get in.
I was. For one, with this, I think most of the smoke, smokers tend to take in less than half of the smoke from a cigarette. So I think actually what may end up improving things is the fire-safe cigarettes may actually help in that. Secondly, the risk for people who are exposed to secondhand smoke, who are non-smokers, is about 20% for lung cancer and heart disease. So you would see a reduction in that excess risk of death. And in lung cancer, that excess risk of death would probably fall much more slowly than, say, for heart disease. There are two studies in Helena, Montana, and Pueblo, Colorado, that documented that an indoor smoking ban that included bars and restaurants and whatnot had a substantial and statistically significant reduction in heart attack admittance rates in local hospitals, and they used a variety of population controls, and these were very short term, and we do know that among smokers, when they quit, that their excess risk for heart attack and stroke will fall by about half within the first 2 years. So it's biologically plausible for this short term reduction in heart attacks and heart attack admittance from non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke to occur in the short term. In fact, in Helena, when the ban was repealed, heart attack admittances immediately went back up to their previous level. I would also add that the concern for children on this bill, from my perspective as a father of a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old, who are both musicians and jazz musicians, is that one thing I worry about is at the point if they choose this as their career, they're going to have to either choose their health or their career for playing, because they'll have to play in a smoke-filled nightclubs. And I am thankful that most of the music scene is in California and New York, and they are covered by bans.
One other question, Mr. Valley, in the -815s, and I know you're not a huge fan of the -815s, but the preemption is lifted statewide,
right.
And so I guess the concern that I have, being more sympathetic to the -15s,
right,
is that we would see cities or counties just simply preempt what we put in of allowing these adult establishments to just stay in business. You're closer to the action at the city and county level than I am. Is that a fear I ought to have?
Well, I think one of the things that we found in 2001, Chair Deckard, is that when the original state law was passed in 2001, we saw that people who were concerned about clean indoor air were worried about a level playing field, and that there was going to be sort of, you know, certain cities that were going to be stronger smoke free or not. From our perspective, we felt part of the reason was that when we were trying, there's a lot of success of passing stronger clean indoor air laws at the local level, because some of the influence in this building is not as influential maybe in some of the local communities from people who are against strengthening the clean indoor air law. So what we would like to see in this legislation, if there is a removal of this preemption, we're allowing communities, if they want to go stronger than the current state law, that they have that ability to. That is up to them if they want to, but we think in some instances, if they feel that it's in the best interest of the public health, they will, and then their local decision makers will make that decision. That was prohibited back in 2001 when there were several communities looking at going stronger. So I think it's a good thing to allow the local communities. Whether or not they're going to do that, I don't know. I mean, this cigar bar exemption was something that happened recently. So I think what we're hopeful is that we can move forward, protect as many people as we possibly can. If that happens, then local communities will evaluate for themselves if they want to go further or not. I think that's the best answer I can give at this point.
So I'll take that as, yes, you should be fearful if you're sympathetic to the -815s, that certainly is a possibility out there.
All I can say is right now, I mean, no one's thinking about that. The goal is, when it came out of the committee, is that we understood, and I think it was accepted at least by the majority of the Judiciary Committee, that we needed to protect people from this. And that we were trying to find an exemption for those places where there were potentially where people really chose to be exposed to this, and that's where the tobacco retail shop exemption, and we went along with that. And so we're trying to narrowly tailor the cigar bar exemption in a similar way. So it's those specific places where people want to go smoking. Now, if we're able to accomplish that, and it's really truly just those places, I can't imagine a lot of people, if that's the way it's being implemented, that people would go after those places. If it's really, truly those cigar bars, the one I'm most familiar with is a place called Trump's in southeast Portland behind the Baghdad Theater. It's McMinimum's. And there's specifically a place where people are going to smoke cigars. And if that is really the place that is covered under this amendment, and that's how it's implemented over time, I don't see a huge groundswell of grassroots people saying we need to go and outlaw those Trumps as the same as the retail shops. I can't say for sure, but I think the concern is those workers and those waitresses and those bartenders that we heard about during the Judiciary Committee hearings. And if it becomes very evident that the cigar bars and these tobacco retail shops are not really the danger point that we're concerned, because it's more of a loophole or the possibility of everyone and their other businesses saying, well, now we're a cigar bar. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, then I think there would be a concern. But we're hopefully going to neutralize that by adopting a very narrowly tailored cigar bar exemption. So I hope that, I can't say for sure, but I think that's the reality of where things stand.
It's more helpful, the second answer. Senator Burdick.
I think we have to apply the Magoo's test. If Magoo's becomes a cigar bar, then I think we'll know we're in trouble.
Right. They'd have to sell $10,000 worth of cigars. Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate the testimony. Again, it's important to note that anytime we're very used to folks challenging our data in terms of LRO, and it is the Legislative Revenue Office, like the forecast that we get in a week, is the Office of Economic Analysis for the state. They're not going to meet, obviously, for 30 minutes. So can you just, if we can let Judy Hall know that as they talk, we're actually working. That was gratuitous. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, can I look a 5-minute, 3-minute, 2-minute recess to speak with Senator Burdick?
Yeah, do you want to do it now or do you want to do it? I was going to let the last panel go and then I was going to recess. And
okay.
I think it's a quick panel. And Mr. Rowe, I know, is not from the Capitol, so I was going to let him. And Mr. Rowe, somehow I knew the cowboy hat. And Dave Nelson from Portland Meadows and Sean Miller. And then we will recess. Senator Monroe.
Chair Deckert, my name is Steve Rowe. I own Cascade Cigar and Tobacco in southeast Portland. I had the opportunity to testify before Senator Burdick's committee in Eugene, and unfortunately, due to the confusion associated with being at Lewis and Clark, was not allowed the opportunity to testify at the subsequent hearing at Lewis Clark where the Dash amendments were considered. In particular, as 571 came out of the Judiciary Committee, it put a fairly tight restriction on smoke shops, particularly with related to the 75%. As it turns out, for my business, it is not an issue. I can meet that number without a whole lot of problem, but I know there's other smoke shops who will probably have a bigger issue with it. So I just comment that it's probably more restrictive than anticipated, or maybe that's what was anticipated. In addition, with regards to that bill, it does put a fairly severe restriction, as I testified at that hearing. We do operate a lounge for cigar customers. We serve beer and wine. It puts very tight restrictions on us in the hours of operations, 3 to 8. I guess we got to go home before the kids go to bed or something. We do routinely run cigar events, and they run past 8 p.m., they typically will go to 10 p.m. because the customers are there to enjoy the cigars, and telling them to clear out at 8 o'clock or we can't serve them a glass of beer or wine really is a fairly heavy restriction in relation to how we operate our lounge, considering when you look at the A15 and the essentially no restrictions on hours of operations for a cigar bar. So to us, that doesn't make sense from a personal basis. So from a smoke shop standpoint, those are my comments with regards to 571 as it currently exists. I'm intrigued on a general basis. I'm a cigar smoker. I can go many days where I smoke no cigars. I might smoke one cigar. I might smoke 5 cigars. If I go to a trade show, I'll smoke 10 cigars in a day in sampling cigars. But it's a personal choice. And I heard testimony from Senator Gordley that said she was prohibited from attending musical events at certain bars where smoking was allowed. Well, that's a matter of choice. similar for the musicians. It's a matter of choice. Do you want to work or do you not want to work? For the bar owners, it's been a matter of choice. Do I want to serve these customers or not? And for the smokers. And so by putting the restrictions, which I believe are going to pass in any case, a matter of choice has been restricted. You know, there's a whole group of the population that is now restricted that they have no choice. They have no place that they can go sit and smoke a cigarette. I'm not a cigarette smoker, so it doesn't have a big impact on me. A comment on with regards to the previous panel. It's interesting to note that Dr. Cohn, I believe he works at OHSU, in March, a publication, a group of scientists from OHSU released a study that they did in calculating the reduction in lung cancer if you removed the top 20 known cancer-producing agents in cigarette, tobacco, and they concluded it would result in less than a 2% reduction in lung cancer rates. No press in our local, no publication carried that particular study on a local basis. It was touched on in a national study. It goes to show we don't understand what is going on here when you can take out the top 20 cancer-producing elements in cigarette, tobacco, and impact lung cancer by less than 2% overall. Finally, with regards to the comments on the financial revenue calculations, I do believe there's a cross-border calculation that has been included in the legislative's function. They were able to track that in relation to Washington and seeing what happened when Washington instituted its smoking bans, how many people from Washington came across the border and how it changed our cigarette tax revenues. It also had a significant impact on bar revenues, I believe, in Jansen Beach. That's no way for you to get that formalized except to go to interview bar owners, but I've heard this from many people who do go to bars up at the Jansen Beach area that they saw significant influx. So there will be a cross-border impact. There is no doubt about it in my mind that a smoking ban in Oregon will have an impact in relation to the people from Washington that come into Portland, cross over into Ontario out of Idaho, and other states. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience this morning. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson representing Portland Meadows Racecourse. And we're here in support of the A13 amendments, which would exempt Portland Meadows Racecourse from the prohibitions in Senate Bill 571. We think it's a very narrowly constructed exemption in that there are six race meets in the state of Oregon. All others are essentially open-air grandstand facilities, and Portland Meadows is the only enclosed race course facility. Our concerns are basically from the reduction in revenue and the reduction in patronage from our competition. And our competition really isn't other restaurants. Our competition is basically the lottery and other Indian casinos. And those Indian casinos are not smoke-free places. And so to the extent that our smoking patrons would choose to go to one of the Indian casinos, that would have a significant impact on the reduction of revenue on Portland Meadows. As you all know, we've been around telling you that Portland Meadows is struggling and has struggled in the face of lottery and Indian casino competition for a long time. But we think our building has the option to provide and the opportunity to provide a smoke-free workplace for all of our employees, and we have many employees in smoke-free workplaces today. We have our building, by the way, is 300 feet long. It's 160 feet wide. It's three stories. It has 10 entrances, and only three of those entrances would be sheltered if somebody wanted to go outside and smoke to comply with the provisions of the bill. So we think that we're in the process. We think that we can and will commit to you to make 75% of our facility smoke-free, and no permanent employers or no employees in any of the 25% remainder that would be allowed to smoke in that area. But we do have a significant percentage of our patrons who smoke. We have a significant percentage of the horsemen who bring their horses to Portland Meadows to race smoke as well. So we think we get kind of a double whammy out of a total prohibition. So we would ask that you consider Portland Meadows, the A13 amendment for the single facility in the state of Oregon to be able to work with its patrons and its horsemen and its supporters of the event to make and comply with, I think, the spirit of 571.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association. They are the bingo halls that operate and are regulated by the Department of Justice, who actually get their revenue and contribute their revenue towards the charitable organizations. With me today is actually Jock Elder, the president of the association, so I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman, and let him testify. But I do want to explain the amendments and want the committee to consider the impacts, the revenue impacts to charity in this state, because I know there's been a lot of discussion on revenue impacts to the businesses as well as the state, but I have not heard any significant discussion with the committee on the impact of charity. And again, these organizations run bingo halls that contribute to very valuable charities for the state of Oregon. And absent the legislature backfilling that money for charity, charities are going to have a significant impact if 571 passes as is. Before you are two amendments that we drafted, and I wanted just to briefly discuss them. The A11 is an all-out exemption for the charitable gaming bingo halls. But the A14, Mr. Chairman, is actually just an extension of for charitable gaming halls to be able to continue till 2010. I think I heard the A14s was an all-out, taking all of the elements of the exemptions within 571. And I want to clarify, I believe it is only, and I'll ask the staff, on lines 18 of the dash A14 amendments, it only includes smoking in bingo halls, and it extends it to 2010. And I know there's been discussion of extending it to 2009. From the charity's sake, at least having 2 years to try to figure out and adjust backfilling money, that revenues that may be lost or that will be lost because of the loss of charity, our organization looked at that very carefully, and we're not here to advocate on the smoking or health issues. We're just here to ask the committee to consider the revenue impacts. The A14s give us those 2 years to be able to figure out how to backfill those money for these important charities. Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Jack Elder. Thank you.
And Mr. Miller, I'm sorry, we are just right up against the clock.
I will keep it very short.
Thank you.
Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, essentially what it comes down to is if this bill passes, 60 to 70% of our people who play do smoke. We know we will lose some of them. If we lose as few as 10% of them, we could fall into an area where we can't comply by the Charitable Activities Division of the Department of Justice to maintain our licenses. We produce revenues across the state some essentially $3, $5, $10 million a year, depending upon which licensee you're working with. And if those revenues disappear, the services are not going to wind up with the community. We thank you very much. There's much more statistical information I could give to you, but essentially we're a byproduct. We will be a casualty, a side casualty, a not mentioned casualty of this effort. So we would ask you to just look at the extension and possibly the exemption as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Perry. For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association. I want to quickly say first, I appreciate Chair Burdick of the other committee with moving the date and switching the feet from 25 to 10. I do appreciate it. I think a lot of people were expecting the ballot measure to pass, so that is, I think, somewhere where we may end up anyway. I did want to make a quick correction. During legislative staff's presentation, I know why I think the revenue thing came out the way it was. The information, I have the sheet that was given to staff by the lottery, and the line, the yellow line that was on the thing, said that that was the year it was implemented. But when you look at the description that was not included on that side, it said Eugene instituted a smoking ban in July 1 of 2002. That was inaccurate information. The ban in Eugene was actually implemented in 2001. Because 3953, which is the bill we passed, was in the 2000 session, and it it actually grandfathered in the Eugene example. So they passed that during session, I think, expecting us to pass the statewide measure. So that first year where it showed a 9% loss, staff was given the information that was the year before the ban. That's inaccurate. That was actually the first year of the ban. And when you look at the statewide figures were flat that year, the second half of that year was actually under the statewide ban, and there were also bans in place in St. Helens, Tillamook, Eugene, all of Benton County. Since then, St. Helens and Tillamook had lifted their bans in that previous year, so you started to see it start to increase. So I would argue that there were a lot of people that year that, since the statewide ban, even though they could have smoking, opted out. They just took that as their option. So that was the flat year, and since then the market has stabilized. So the information given to staff about Eugene was inaccurate. It was January 1 of 09, so that 9% loss was under the first year of full implementation of the Eugene ban. So I don't know. I would like to see a potential clarification in that in the revenue figures.
Okay.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator George, and then I have one question. Senator George.
Thank you, guys. If I was a member of a group that owned a casino, I'd really be in here trying to kill every one of these amendments because I think the bill, as it's originally written, ought to be the Tribal Casino Enhancement Act, because what this is going to do is, no matter what you're interested in, whether it's horse racing, whether it's bingo or any other kind of gambling or smoking, with the lottery, you're going to go to a casino. Because then you can do everything you want. I want a response from you guys on what appears to me to be an opportunity here, if we pass this bill unamended, to have a tremendous competitive advantage for tribal casinos.
Well, yes, it would. There's no question of it. People would drive there so they could enjoy both of their vices. We accept that concept. We're currently benefiting, because we're right on the Columbia River, from the Washington ban. We're getting people across the way, and those people will travel further, and or if the other casino is built, they'll be traveling closer. So,
Bill Perry, for the record, I would say that when talking about statewide bans, Las Vegas or Nevada was a statewide ban but exempted casinos. Just from our marketplace, I would say that we're a convenience gambling type, so I think you'll have Lincoln City, Coos Bay, some of the, like McMinnville, where you might see a transition. But really, when you look at what happened in Corvallis and Eugene, there wasn't a transition from Corvallis to Albany. Albany stayed pretty stagnant when you showed actually there the year after it declined. But when you talked to Eugene and Springfield operators, you didn't see really a transition from a certain period. If it's a mile or less than a mile, they might. But ours is more of a convenience style, so I just think there's going to be a decline in the gaming revenue. I think your food and alcohol could come back. There's going to be winners and losers we could talk about, but I would say that, it's ours is more of a convenience gamble. It's just going to be a loss of revenue.
On the A-15s, I know this isn't your fight, or if it is, I don't know it. Ought I be concerned about local, or do you know from other states, Mr. Perry, that they haven't come in because they're a small segment of Mr. Valley said it's a large... is it something that the Restaurant Association would be concerned or is concerned?
Well, for the record, Bill Perry, once again, I really, when you look at cigar bars, the only places are going to be is Eugene and Portland. And I think that I would just say that I haven't had a lot of success working with those local governments on too many of my issues. So I guess put it very politely. So I guess if your protection is what you're looking for, then I would say I'd be concerned. But
there are cigar bars in other, I would think, in Pendleton and
Mr. Chair.
Senator Shaw.
Just to kind of chime in on this conversation, the way that this bill is drafted, the cigar bar, I think you won't find any in Oregon, because the cigar bars that I'm aware of, and I would suggest we had testimony about Trump's, and I've never been to Trump's or seen Trump's, but I would be surprised if Trump's even sells $10,000 worth of cigars. Most cigar bars that I'm aware of, people bring their own cigars, for one, and go to a place and enjoy the company of friends and whoever mm-hmm. to smoke cigars and bring their own. Mm-hmm. You can purchase, at the bar, but I'm most familiar with one that my constituents enjoy at the Cornelius Pass Roadhouse, the White Shed. It's the only place on the premises that you can smoke cigars. Very small, little White Shed that's heated with a little wood stove. They don't sell, they have a humidor there, but I guarantee you they don't sell $10,000 worth of cigars. And I would suggest that this is smoke and mirrors, this amendment here.
Mm. And for the record, the only cigar bars I know, and I agree with Senator Stark, they wouldn't meet that example, is the McMinnum's Trump one. I know there's one in El Gaucho and one in Morton's, and I would doubt, obviously, that they fit the exemption because they don't have an outside door. You come into the main door and then over. It is walled off and everything else, but I doubt they would fit the exemption. Those are the only cigar bars I'm aware of.
They would not fit the exemption.
I don't think so.
Because of
it's drafted so narrowly that nobody's going to be able to. We can pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, we took care of cigar bars, but I don't see. With how narrowly this amendment has been crafted, that you're going to find cigar bars that meet the criteria that are in this bill, this amendment.
It's Bill Donovan. Bill Donovan worked on it, and thank you very much. We've moved over to the. Bill, can you convince us? I'll tell you, I'm obviously sympathetic to the A15, and I believe that White Shed ought to be able to stay in business and continue, and that would be what I'd want to see in an amendment.
Chair Deckard, Senators, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan, Government Affairs Representative for the American Heart Association. I can just share with you that we looked across the nation when we were asked about cigar bar exemptions and found that there were 7 states that had cigar bar exemptions. And in looking at those exemptions, we found the majority of those states were based, the exemption was based on the amount of revenue, of revenue. So, for example, Massachusetts said, if you're going to be a cigar bar, 51% of your revenue has to come from the sale of cigars. And we saw that as being kind of the strictest, the highest level of a cigar bar exemption. But more recently, and frankly, under the Massachusetts example, I would agree with you. I don't think that the White Shed or the Little Red Shed or Trump's or any of those would make 51% of the revenue because they sell alcohol, food, etc. In looking at some of the other states, we saw what just was passed last month in the state of New Mexico, and that was where we came up with the $10,000 threshold. That's $2,005 cigars. Quite frankly, having been to the Little Red Shed, I don't think selling 2,000 cigars is difficult for them at all, and probably more of their cigars are above $5 than at the $5 level. But I'm not an expert on that. We basically just looked at what other states had done. Frankly, thought that this was a very reasonable threshold. And so it was drafted as such. Some of the other things that you'll find contained in the legislation are, a humidor on the premise. I was just in Rich's tobacco shop this weekend because I was kind of curious. You can pick up a humidor for $50. So I don't think that that's terribly difficult to meet that standard. We wanted to make sure that they had alcohol and food sales, so you see that in there and do not offer lottery games. That was basically enough to make sure that this didn't become just a loophole, that truly these are cigar bars where aficionados are frequenting, thus the ventilation system requirement that you see in there. And basically that was our input into these amendments. Some of the other components of it were ideas from Senator Burdick.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Donovan. Let's recess for 5 minutes and come back at 10:45. If folks are, we'll recess for 5 minutes and come back at 10:45. I'll say it loudly so that if the two other members, Senator Monroe is around somewhere.
And Senator George.
And Senator George is also close by.
He's oh, is that correct? Just got some inside scoop.
Yeah, you did. okay, so we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 571. And if I could just say one thing about the A-15s, just a by time for Senator George. One thing that I would like to do, and if the committee would like to go in this direction, is to change the 10,000 in the A-15s on page 2, line 12, from a 10,000 to a 5,000 figure. So when the motion's made, I'm just getting that out there, and we've got Senator George joining us. So just putting that out there is when we make that motion, I would ask if the motion is made that we also conceptually change line 2 on the 15. On the A-15s, line 2, page 12, to, from the 10,000 to the 5,000 for...
Okay, Mr. Chair, for the record, it's line 12, page 2.
Am I saying page 12, yeah. Line 2?
Yeah. And I would normally not correct you, Mr. Chair, but we are on the record, so.
But he was pointing at the right number.
Correct away. Appreciate that. So line 2, page 12, when we...
line 12, page 2, Mr. Chair.
Now you know what it's like to, like, be married to me and ask for directions or something is... okay, so page 2, line 12, when we get to that moment. Okay, so we're in work session. I'll recognize Senator Burdick first, who's...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this, on the bill and the amendments. I don't like any of the exemptions that we are contemplating today. I don't believe that any worker in Oregon is less deserving of the kind of public health protection that this bill provides than any other worker. However, I do understand that we live in a political environment and that the cigar bar owners of the world have a great advocate in you, Mr. Chair. And so I have worked in good faith with all concerned on this amendment. I don't intend to support it for the reasons I just gave, but I will not vote against the bill with this amendment in it. And this is the only one I can say that about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
Would you like a motion on the A-15th with the conceptual amendment?
That'd be great if you'd like to.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A-15 amendments to Senate Bill 571 with the conceptual amendment on line 12, page 2, deleting the 10,000 and inserting 5,000.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Senator Starr has moved the dash A-15 amendments with one change conceptually to them, and that is on page 2, line 12, the 10,000 becomes a 5,000. Discussion of that motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I am I'm going to support this amendment, but I will be. I want to be clear for the record. I do not believe that there are very many cigar bars anywhere in the state that will survive under the strict language that this amendment entails, including this conceptual amendment, Mr. Chair. It's unclear to me, and again, the only place that I'm familiar with, and it's because it's my constituents frequent this, is the White Shed at the Cornelius Pass Roadhouse. It's unclear to me whether having a separate building that's part of a larger establishment would constitute a cigar bar or not. That's unclear as far as I'm concerned. And you know, I don't know the business situation at that particular establishment, other than that they do have a humidor there. It is an unheated, has a wood stove. Maximum people that, you know, even if they crammed shoulder to shoulder in there, would be less than two dozen. You know, I don't know that they would be able to comply with whatever ventilation system. All they have is doors and windows that open. People, adults only can go there. They go there by choice to enjoy the experience of smoking cigars and eating and drinking. So I'm unsure whether this particular exemption for cigar bars actually will accomplish what I think the chair would hope to accomplish, but in hopes that it does some good, I'm offering them and will support them.
Thank you. And just, you know, in conversations with the Department of Human Services and the Public Health Office, I feel, and it's relatively confident in talking to them, that establishments like the White Shed would meet the test. And that existing, and certainly getting that legislative intent here and on the floor also. In discussions with them, I believe they will meet the test of this amendment. Obviously, sales not being a sales tax state will be the hardest, but I think they understand what the legislature wants to do on this question if we do adopt this amendment, and that is to allow existing establishments, like all the sheds out there, red and white. I guess there's a red one and the McMinimums, and I believe they've talked to the owners of the McMinimums about those two sheds and their viability under the A-15s. Yes, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, when we look at the revenue impact, and I believe that that's the real, probably closest to the real number, and the very fact that we're talking about businesses, like, for example, with A-13, with that amendment, if these businesses don't, if we don't provide the help, I mean, they're gone. And if I had my druthers, it would be 11, 13, and 14, and 15. I would just like to have a discussion about those. I mean, do you want me to move, like, for Dash 11 amendments?
Yeah, you are. I mean, after we get with the A-15s, okay, I am more than okay with us voting and talking about the different choices being aware of the time. But that is, I think that's a good discussion to have. This is obviously a tough issue, civil liberties, business, and public health all in one bill. Other questions on the Dash A-15s? Barbara, can you call the roll on the A-15s with the conceptual amendment on page 2, line 12?
Senator Burdick.
No.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
No.
Senator Clark.
Aye.
Votes aye. A-15s pass. Senator George.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we just do a discussion. We have major amendments. I don't know when I'm going to get this straight. Amendments 11 and 14 that are very similar. I would prefer the stronger language of 11. What's the attitude or what's the consensus of the group here today?
What? My position, and I'm somewhat sympathetic, certainly, on the Portland Meadows issue. I think it's a legitimate concern. What I have pledged to the sponsors of this bill is that I will let those will not occur here, so I would be voting no on them. But I'm happy to if folks want to discuss each one of them, to discuss them. But I know I couldn't be supportive of just because of a pledge that I've made to two or three of the sponsors of this legislation.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, let me include A-13 in that list, too, then, if we're going to just have a discussion. I would support all of those.
Do you want to move them all at once?
No. I'm just hoping to have a discussion here as to whether we have a chance for anything.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't appear that the discussion is necessary because it appears that the majority of the committee has made a commitment, at least enough of the committee has made a commitment to move the bill with only the A-15s, but I'd like to have a vote at least on the A-13, so I'll move the A-13s.
Okay, so Senator Starr has moved the A-13 amendments to Senate Bill 571 discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
This amendment affects one business in the state of Oregon, and that's Portland Meadows, where the work areas, and I've talked to a lot of people about this, the work areas in Portland Meadows are smoke-free. They do have a smoking area in a very large gallery area that there are not employees regularly assigned to. And so employees, the purpose of this is to make sure that non-smoking workers not be exposed to secondhand smoke. I believe that's the case at Portland Meadows. Also, they compete, because they're a gambling establishment, they compete directly with Indian casinos. And where the like establishments across the country where a complete smoking ban took place, the facility closed. And so this being the only facility of its type in Oregon, horse breeders and horse owners are very interested in it staying open. And also, of course, the many hundreds of employees that work there are interested in keeping their jobs. I have a conflict of interest on the A13 Amendment. My daughter-in-law is an employee of Portland Meadows. I will be supporting the A13 Amendment.
We're going to have further discussion.
Mr. Chair, I cannot, in good conscience, vote for a bill that is loaded up in this way. I very reluctantly agreed to support a bill with the dash A15s. And I think perhaps it might be better, given Senator Monroe's position, if we took a break from this discussion and perhaps involved a bigger group of people because of the implications.
Yeah, that's, I'm thinking we might have to recess. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, we have a motion on 13. I'd like to go ahead and vote if we could at this point.
We'll
take a recess. I need to meet with you if you're going to recess.
Okay, so we will recess for five more minutes until 11:05 and 2 o'clock. So we'll stand in recess till 2 and post which room we come back to. We're in recess. Mm-hmm. So,